Well, I need to read. And so he would read the lives of a Francis of Assisi. Heroes, biographies, Francis of Assisi, a Dominic, some of these great figures who led lives of service. And he frequently didn't like the way it started. Didn't like it. Oh, I'll read it. But at the end, he felt better. He didn't feel slimy. He didn't feel like he needed to take a shower. He felt uplifted. This was the beginning of his understanding of self-understanding. What builds my insides to the insides of a human being responding to God's grace? What demeans me? What makes me humiliated in the bad sense? What makes me feel worthless? I want to choose one and avoid the other. This, by the way, again, is why fourth step is so important. We take a look at our behavior. Where do I end up feeling worthless? Where do I end up feeling valuable and cherished? And these are questions that we get to ask in our recovery. And we can simply say some things we never have to do again. Ever. I used to love rescuing people who didn't want to be rescued. And then, of course, it would feel great at the beginning, and I would be totally nuts at the end of the day or the evening or the week or the month. Angry at them. I don't do that, for the most part, anymore when I'm in my right mind. There are other things, sometimes I have to draw lines, you know, I can't do this. And it feels awful at the beginning, but at the end, I know it was the right choice. We start to make decisions about how our behavior goes. Frequently, rescuing people we love starts feeling sweet and we end up feeling awful. Notice that. We're drawing a line, setting a boundary, not enabling, feels awful at the beginning, but at the end, we know that this was a better choice. One other, or two other points, and then we can do lunch. Or at least mosey into that area. A note on spirituality. There's all kinds of ways that people lead spiritual lives. Even in the program, there's all kinds of ways people lead spiritual lives. As you work the program, you have to find out what works for you and what doesn't work for you. I mean, it's a very flexible thing, but we need to find out what works for each one of us. And when we talk to each other, we get to share our own experience, strength, and hope. Instead of telling people what they should and shouldn't be doing, which is one of my gifts, I find when I'm in my right mind, I can share my experience, strength, and hope with them. And then that shows them the respect of giving them the chance of making some choices. For a while, this one fellow, he wanted me to give him advice. And it's like the first drink, you know, you just can't give advice once. So I would give him advice and then he wouldn't do it. And then he'd be angry at me for trying to run his life. So it took me 3 or 4 or 5 times to figure that out. And then now I don't do that. I approach it very differently. And he's right. I mean, I can't do that. I get to maybe show him some of his options. But I don't tell him what to do. Even though it would be easier for me if I did. Because I'd feel in charge, which is one of my favorite feelings. Well, I'm in charge of so many people I sponsor. It's just not true. I rather, my current attitude is I'm amazed at anybody who calls. You know, really, are you okay? Whew. And you called, good news. It is a daily gift. Recovery in any form is a daily gift. Rather than being total loons. But there are lots of spiritualities. Within my denomination, which is a very large and old one, there are lots of ways that people see things that are very different. Now, for those of you who are not Catholic, just take my word for this. And for those of you who are, reflect a little bit on your experience. There are whole different spiritualities within the Catholic Church. Franciscans are totally different from Dominicans, are totally different from Carmelites, are totally different from Benedictines, are totally different from Jesuits. You'll find, like, some of the spiritualities, like the Benedictines, are very much attuned to the desert. That's where they thrive, the desert. The Franciscans are very rural, farms, back countries, you know, away from the cities. The Jesuits, and this is a Jesuit retreat house, the Jesuits are people of the cities. It's where we live, it's how we think, it's how we put things together. Ignatius of Loyola always loved the cities, not the rural areas. They bored him to tears. There are different places, and as you begin your own recovery, you'll find out that some places feel like home and others don't. Some people hate cities, then leave. Some people love the country, go there. You know, deserts feed you, please go. You know, if not to live, at least to visit. If the redwoods are the place where you connect, go. I was talking to someone a while ago. Just a footnote. Many of us, again, we know things, but we don't act on them. This person loved the redwoods and just felt so good at the redwoods and called me and was having a pretty bad time. And I remembered that redwood conversation, and I said, which I usually don't. And I said, how long since you've been to the redwoods? And he said, 8 or 10 years. See, he knew, but he needed to act. He needed, I mean, there was nothing I could say other than, I think it's a good idea. You know, when I go to the redwoods, I'm glad. Go spend time there. This is part of self-information. It's part of self-discovery. You know? So I know, in recovery, I know some real important things about me. For my idea of a good vacation, it's not to go to the seashore. No. And it's not, I think I'll go to a small town. My idea of a great vacation is a city with Jewish delicatessens and foreign movies. You know, and I feel sensational at the end of something like that. I had other friends when I was much younger. We were told what to do much more frequently. The control was much higher. And the people who were in charge liked going to out-of-the-way places and doing nothing, you know. That's how I would see it. Oh, we could go river rafting. I said, right. You know, I don't have to do that to be happy. You got to do what makes you happy, which means you have to try lots of things. And this is my last pitch for the morning. Part of recovery... A large part of recovery is trial and error. Seeing things, sampling things, opening doors, closing doors. It's all about change. And it's all about taking risks. It really is. For some of you who are on your first retreat, this is a big risk. And it's a big deal. And I just want to congratulate you for trying anything new. Hopefully it's not an awful experience, you know. And I find that a lot of times... I don't know if I like something for a while. I've got to see what it feels like. In fact, I might have to do it 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 times before I know if I like it or not. This is true for movies. I'll see a movie, and at the end of the movie, I don't know if I liked it. I feel so stupid in those circumstances. Or I'll remember I saw the movie, but I can't remember a thing about it. Or I'm 2/3 of a way through a book before I realize I've read it before. I really feel stupid. So what I have to remember is this is a perfectly valid way of learning. Instead of saying, I should be quicker on the draw. Also, you can don't have to buy new books. You can just reread things and be totally content. But it's the risk-taking, and it's the allowing ourselves to feel ignorant and allowing ourselves to feel imperfect and allowing ourselves to be vulnerable. And if we can do that, God's grace, I think, really flows in our lives. We do a lot of conversation about us seeking God. God could and would, if God were sought. Seeking God. Where do I find God? I've lost connection with God. This becomes big questions for a lot of us in recovery. Well, yes, yes, yes. But one of my understandings, it's not just that we seek God, but God seeks us. God seeks us. How on earth did you get to your first meeting? Some of us were dragged. Some of us were pushed. Some of us brought a friend. A friend left, we stayed. Very odd. God seeks us. And so one of the rabbis, when he talks about God at work, will say, God at work is like a woman who lost a coin, searches the whole house for the coin, and when she finds the coin, is thrilled. God is like a shepherd who loses one sheep and looks all over the place till he finds the sheep and then is really happy. It's the notion of God seeking us and then responding with joy that is the notion I'd like to leave you with tonight or this afternoon. And sometimes what we can best do in our spiritual lives is run away from God less quickly. Slow down and let God reach you. Do less. Let God find you. I told that story of, you know, the shepherd finding the lost sheep and bringing him home, and everyone's glad. And one of my friends, who has a little dark side to him, says, "What do you think they had for dinner that night?" I'm sure they were vegetarians. Lamb. So, this is along the line of, you know, the notion of when the lion lies down with the lamb won't get much sleep. But anyway, let's break. And for this afternoon, you know, after lunch, sleeping is a very spiritual exercise. Sleep if you can. Go for a walk if you can. Do some writing if you can. Do some, you know, conversation with people when you can. It is just grand. And enjoy the afternoon. This is a Saturday. And to start off a little bit talking this afternoon, I want to address a few comments to those of us who are type A personalities and overachievers and very responsible, serious types who had to run the family because no one else was. And the notion I'd like to introduce, and I'm not going to tell you what to do about it, but it's a real ancient one, and I've just started doing some thinking about this myself as I nudge 50 years old. It's the notion of Sabbath day. The notion of Sabbath day. And I think it does need to get talked about because in our culture we don't have one. We're very busy people all the time. And if you're not busy, there's something terribly wrong with you. The notion of Sabbath. It's interesting, one of the Ten Commandments, which is as valid as any of the others, you know, it's as important as any of the other of the commandments, is to keep holy the Sabbath. And what happens with church folk is we'll break out into fistfights over which is the Sabbath day. Whatever the Sabbath day is irrelevant. But the observance of Sabbath is a spiritual exercise. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit this afternoon. The children of Abraham all have a real strong sense of Sabbath. For Muslims, it's Friday. For Jews, it's Saturday. For Christians, it's Sunday. But this sense of Sabbath day, and if you're a little nuts, you get it all wrong. And you see it as a day to punish people for working. There are going to be, in Cromwell's England, all kinds of things get outlawed, and if you violated them, they'd fine you, you know, thus making you really look forward to Sabbath day. I was reading a book by an American rabbi named Heschel, and Rabbi Heschel, H-E-S-C-H-E-L, is one of the great minds of modern-day Judaism. And if you ever want to read something written by a thoughtful, prayerful man, anything by Rabbi Heschel is well worth study. And he has written a series of reflections on Sabbath. So I'm kind of fussing with that book, which means I read it and then put it down, and then read it, then put it down, then lose it, and then find it, and then read it for 4 days, and then put it down. That's how I frequently read books. I know I should be more disciplined, but it's not going to happen. So relax. Okay. Heschel says his first observation, most spiritual and religious traditions have sacred places. Mecca, you know, go to Mecca, make pilgrimage. Jerusalem, go to the Wailing Wall. The River Ganges, you go there. People make pilgrimage to sacred places. In fact, you'll even find some people in Alcoholics Anonymous who will make pilgrimages to Dr. Bob's house, you know. We were in Akron. Look, I have a nail from Dr. Bob's house. And you're talking, when you talk like that, you're talking to someone who's a member of a religion who took that kind of stuff real seriously and used it as a major fundraising thing for centuries, you know. Relics, selling relics. They had a whole series of, it was like Barnum and Bailey sometimes. They would have relics and they'd move them around from town to town and people would come to see the relics. And in the Middle Ages, pre-Reformation, there were relics like nails from the True Cross, of course, were always being able to be shown. A feather from the Holy Spirit, that was one of them. The last breath of St. Joseph, that was one of them. How'd they get that? They killed him, you know. Bag over his head. Another regular one was milk from the breast of the Blessed Virgin. Yeah, people would just line up to see this stuff, you know. So I always get a little anxious when people start talking about relics from Akron. One of my favorite relics from the Middle Ages, though, was the head of St. John the Baptist as a child. You think I'm making that up? I'm not. There actually was. You could go and see his head as a child. One born every minute, you know. That's always. But Sabbath. Get back to the Sabbath notion. So there are holy places. Rabbi Heschel said, Judaism has a holy time. Not just a place that is sacred, but a time that is sacred. And when Sabbath begins, there's a special relationship that happens between God and every observant Jew. And so then, when does sundown, when does sun up, you know, when does it start? Judaism has its craziness too. Does Sabbath begin at sundown in Jerusalem, or does Sabbath begin sundown in Oakland? You know, they'll break out in fistfights. And in the New York Times on Sabbath on Friday evening, they will list when is sundown today. You see, is it 5:53? That's when the candles are. I mean, people get into this, you know, because on Sabbath you are to do no servile work. Well, what's behind that? See, I always like asking questions like, what's behind that? Because otherwise you get into fistfights over what's work, what's not work, you know. And instead of observing a Sabbath day, you start throwing rocks, you know, as soon as you legally can, of course. Is throwing rock work, or is throwing rock recreation? You can get into those discussions. Sabbath is the day when all human labor is to cease, and God can be God. This is the thinking. And God can be God. We let God reign supreme on Sabbath day. And then the Jewish community would reflect on Sabbath. Why are we taking a day off? Well, in purely secular terms, I mean, this is just in terms of spirit and psychology and human understanding, a day off is a real good idea. I mean, it's a real good idea for those of us who are crazy people, who are busy all the time. In fact, if you look at the way the land works and crops and rotation, part of ecology is to let the land lie fallow every so often. Just let nothing grow there but weeds. I mean, just leave the land alone. Well, then we do a lot of vitamins and stuff to the land and things get a little crazy, you know. But to Sabbath is kind of the fallow day, you see. Sabbath is the day to let body and heart rest. Sleep late.
Don't do much. Low expectations. Process things. Don't be real busy on the Sabbath. There were two kinds of thoughts about this. One, God and Moses are having one of their conversations. They had several. And in the book of Exodus, if I can find this quickly, I'll be real impressed. Exodus 20. I usually, when I need to find something in Scripture, I have to ask one of my Baptist friends, because they know. They know things. Always have Baptist friends. They know things. Where in the Bible does it say? Oh, thank you. Chapter 20 of Exodus, God gives the Ten Commandments. And this is God as they understand God, right? And God is speaking. And God identifies God. You know, I, the one who am talking to you, who am I? I, the Lord, am your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, that place of slavery. That's the introduction. You shall have no other gods beside me. Okay, so boom. Who am I? How do they understand the higher power? Through their experience. And like we understand our higher power through our experience. And their experience is, we were trapped in slavery. Now we're free. We didn't do it. Who did? A power greater than ourselves. And now we're going to get into some kind of relationship with this power. I, the Lord, am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, that place of slavery. Never forget that. Then lots of things get said, and this commandment, this is chapter 20, verse 8. Remember to keep holy the Sabbath day. 6 days you may labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. No work may be done then, either by you or your son or your daughter, or your male or female slave, or your beast, or by the alien who lives with you. It is to be a day off for everybody, you know. And then they give a reason. In 6 days, the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. But on the seventh day, he rested. That is why the Lord has blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. See, so by taking the Sabbath day off, in a way, you're imitating God. God rested, we rest. See? God rested, we rest. Well, life happens. And this whole thing gets repeated again in the book of Deuteronomy, which is one of my favorite names. And I wish more children were named Deuteronomy. There are too many Marys and Franks. You know, how about some little Deuteronomies? In the book of Deuteronomy, which is kind of viewed by many for centuries as the last will and testament of Moses, Moses takes all of Exodus and rewrites it with a bit of a different spin. And Ten Commandments are reintroduced in this chapter, which is chapter 5 of Deuteronomy, and this is how the Ten Commandments begin. I, the Lord, am your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, that place of slavery. Again, the exact same introduction. That's who I am. Then we skip down to this little reflection on the Sabbath day. Take care to keep holy the Sabbath day as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you may labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. No work may be done then. See, so far it's pretty familiar, right? It just parallels the last translation. No work may be done then, whether by you or your son or daughter, or your male or female slave, or your ox, or your ass, or any of your beasts, or the alien who lives with you. Period. Your male and female slave should rest as you do. Notice that gets added. They've already mentioned slaves, but then they repeat slaves. What could be going on? Well, clearly slaves were being forced to work on Sabbath. So, like any law, you deal with the abuse. Even they get the day off. And then, interesting reflection. Instead of saying, because God worked for 6 days and took the seventh day off. A new reason is given for the observance of the Sabbath and the spin that your male and female slave get the day off too. For remember that you too were once slaves in Egypt. And the Lord your God brought you from there with his strong hand and outstretched arm. That is why the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day as a celebration of your passing from slavery to freedom. Now most of us, especially in the United States, which is crazy, workaholic, busy, crazy, stay active, most of us have to very seriously take a look at Sabbath in our lives for our own emotional and spiritual good. Taking time off. Now that might not be once a week. It might be every 10 days or every 2 weeks or once a month. But something has to happen so that we can let ourselves lie fallow. Now on your day off, on your Sabbath, if that's the day that you do your laundry and make all your phone calls and do all the yard work and paint the house, that's not Sabbath. See, that's just busy. Sabbath means stop all unnecessary work. And in the rabbinical tradition, there is a long discussion on what's work, what's not work. It takes chapters and chapters, and there'll be big discussions on this, you know. But I need to know what my day off is like. I find it interesting, for those of us in ministry, you know, in the Christian tradition, since Constantine, Sunday has been the Sabbath day, and what if you're pastor of a parish, and on Sunday you say Mass 6 times and give 6 sermons and deal with 4,000 people? It's not a day off for the pastor. And it's not Sabbath. It might be for the other people, but not for him. Where do you go? What do you do to let your body and soul rest? And for those of us in recovery, these become real important questions. And I really do think, because again, our culture is so crazy. One person calls me regularly, and the big conversation is work stuff, boss stuff. You know, you aren't being paid anymore, but you are expected to work longer hours. And if you complain, there are 6 people ready to take your place. I mean, this is indentured servitude. And it's being done because, in our culture, the only thing we value is the profit line. And I don't care what other family values they give you, the fact is, profit line is the way things run. You know, which makes us all sick. So I need to find ways of observing Sabbath in my life. And I might start that by looking at the way other people observe Sabbath in their lives. And then find some time for this. And again, whether it's weekly or every 2 weeks or once a month or the regular retreat, you know, where once a year or several times a year, you come somewhere just to be fallow as a spiritual exercise. What are you doing for your spiritual life? Very little today. You know, I'm not watching TV, I'm not working out, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing that. I'm just kind of not doing much today for my spiritual health. This is why earlier, as I said, if you're able to take a nap, taking a nap is like taking a little Sabbath. Civilized countries respect siestas very, very much. All the Mediterranean goes to bed, you know, twice a day. It's a real good idea. Most Latin countries do. Most countries with incredible heat take the heat of the day off. We're nuts. And we think you're supposed to keep going all the time because we think people should act like machines. And machines don't take time off. And if you are not as efficient as a machine, you're worthless to us. You know? That goes back to the Paul Bunyan story. You know, Paul Bunyan was not enough. The machine beat him, therefore Paul Bunyan has no value. This is terrifying. No wonder most of us are depressed and crazy. You see. Sabbath helps me respect spiritually my gifts and your gifts, and it's time off. And whether I do it to rejoice in the fact that once I was a slave and now I'm free, or to talk about God's creation and now at rest, it's irrelevant. The fact is, I need the time.
I need a sacred time. And as part of it in the Al-Anon program, see, the reason I especially voice this to those of us in Al-Anon is because many of us are convinced that if we don't concentrate all the time on the problem, it'll blow up. Do you ever find it's, you're afraid to go to sleep at night because what will everybody do if you're unconscious? Well, you know, some of us are convinced that our worry is like glue. And our worrying holds the family together. See? If I wasn't worrying, they'd fly off the map. Or we think that if we're involved in a relationship with our children or, you know, partners, or we've got to worry about them all the time. I'm so worried about you. We think that's being close. Yeah. Oh, we're very intimate. I worry constantly about him. We don't see that as crazy. Sabbath is turning it over. Taking a nap is turning it over. Going to sleep at night is turning it over. You might need, if you are truly crazy, you might need to say something like this: oh God, now for the next few hours I'm going to be asleep. Keep an eye on everything, I'll be back. I've done that because I was so worried, you know. And there is kind of a nice addictive quality to worry. Some of us don't have to do cocaine, we do worry, you know. And it's just as refreshing. As I'm getting older, I find out I just don't have the emotional oomph for worry. It wears me out too fast. Sabbath is a real important idea. And in my thinking right now, I'm tying Sabbath in with step three. Okay. Oh God, go to work. I won't even give you advice today. And then I have to be serious about what Sabbath is for me, because I think it's different for different people. What's work, what's pleasure? If you're a gardener, I mean, like you really are a professional gardener, you don't want to garden on Sabbath day. I'm not a professional gardener, so I can garden. Okay? If you're a lifeguard, there's a real good chance that you won't go swimming on Sabbath day. But if you're not a lifeguard, you can go swimming. It's refreshing. If you're a mom or a professional cook, there's a real good chance that you don't want to cook on Sabbath day. But if you're not a mom or not a professional cook, it might be fun. If you're a movie critic, you don't want to go to movies on Sabbath day. If you're not a professional critic, you can go. We've got to find out what refreshes us, what helps us lie fallow. I usually take Mondays as my Sabbath day. I'm not always good at this, but on my Sabbath day, I usually don't answer the phone and don't return phone calls, you know, because that's what I do all week long. Sleep late, go for a walk, you know. Earlier in this weekend, I mentioned self-acceptance as the key. I don't think we can willpower self-acceptance. I'm going to force myself to accept myself. It doesn't work that way. We can ask for God's help for self-acceptance. Because I think if we can accept ourselves, it's kind of miraculous. One of the stories that one of the rabbis talks about in here, and like most of us are so unhappy with how we've turned out. You know, we should be so much better. Let me see if I really had this chosen earlier, and then I put it down, and Owen and Gary are taping me, and they hate it when I wander around looking for something like this, and I should be more organized, and they'll start criticizing and saying awful things. This is in Matthew's gospel, and it's a little parable, and it's chapter, looks like 13, and around verse 24. Jesus proposed another parable to them. The kingdom of heaven, the presence of God, the Spirit in our midst. Okay, that's kind of all what it's talking about, the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven is likened to a man who sowed good seed in his field. While everyone was asleep, his enemy came and sowed weeds all through the wheat and then went off. When the crop grew and bore fruit, the weeds appeared as well. The slaves of the householder came to him and said, "Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? Where have all the weeds come from?" He answered, "An enemy has done this." His slaves said to him, "Do you want us to go and pull the weeds up?" He replied, "No, if you pull up the weeds, you might uproot the wheat along with them. Let them grow together until harvest. Then at harvest time, I will say to the harvesters, 'First collect the weeds and tie them in bundles for burning, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" Okay. Now, parable is a story that has a point, and it's real easy on stories like this to get really crazy. Oh, this is a parable about hell. Well, burning, it says burning. No, you're nuts. But if your major obsession is hell, you're going to find it here. Here's a little rule of thumb in Scripture. Whatever craziness is going on in your head, you will find in those pages. Trust me. People have for years, and they do, and they have TV shows. Or it's about slavery. It says slave. It's slavery. Not what it's about. Well, what's it about? Who's the wheat? All right, am I wheat or am I weeds? Am I wheat or am I weeds? We are the field. Each one of us is the field. And in each one of us is wheat and weeds. So relax already. Well, what about the last day? God will sort it out. This is God's job. You know, when we hear some of us talking about the defects of character, and again, none of us have any, but we sponsor people who do. You'll hear some of us say, "Oh, you know, I have, my ego's so big. Bad ego. Bad ego." You know? Relax. Just relax, you know. A lot of us have problems with ego, yeah. A lot of us have problems with self-obsession. A lot of us have problems with anger. Welcome to the group. We are the fields. And in the fields, we have wheat and weeds all mixed up. And the level of self-acceptance is to be able to say that out loud without saying, "Bad field." No, interesting field. You know, and I know this as a gardener, as an amateur gardener, but a gardener, a lot of times things that I find to be really pretty are weeds. I have a professional gardener named Judy H., and she comes over and gives me advice occasionally, and still say, "Oh, those things are awful. I really like them." "Oh," she said, "well, I yank them out," and I said, "I plant them." So we have different impressions, you know, wheat and weeds. And we turn all this over to the care of the higher power. Who will sort it through when it's time? Who will sort it through when it's time? One other parable. I just think this one is interesting. He proposed another parable to them, and this is for those of us who get discouraged. The kingdom of heaven, the presence of God, the higher power is stuff, is like mustard seed that a person took and sowed in a field. It is the smallest of all the seeds, yet when full grown, it is the largest of plants. It becomes a large bush, and the birds of the sky come and dwell in its branches. Okay, mustard seed. Mustard seed is a real nice image for recovery, I think, for grace, for healing, for the reason it does start really small, and it grows. Don't be discouraged if all you see is new growth. New growth is tender and it's small. Don't be discouraged if you see a lot of new growth or just seed. It is valuable stuff. Now, one of the commentators I was reading said that what he finds interesting about this little thing here in Matthew is that Jesus talking about the mustard seed starts very small, becomes the largest of all bushes or largest of all trees in one translation. He said, clearly this is not a farmer's kid. Because it's not true. The mustard seed is not the smallest of all seeds, and it doesn't become the biggest of all trees. But if you don't know much about farms, it sounds good. This is someone who spent a little too much time in the carpenter shop. Or in the yeshiva, you know, I mean, trying to learn stuff. So he knows, the story is a good one, it's just not, it's not accurate, but it's a good one. The point is wonderful, but there are bigger bushes than mustard seeds, and we'll tell him that later. And another real simple parable, a way of understanding how does God work. You know, I get self-acceptance. How does God work in our lives? They'll talk about the field, and we are the field. Mustard seed starts real, real small. The other one is yeast. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed with 3 measures of wheat flour until the whole batch was leavened. Now, that's accurate. He probably saw his mom do that. See, so that's, I mean, it's 3 measures of wheat, one of those, boom. Yeast is another great image. And most of us haven't baked. But you might want to try it sometime just for the raw, sensual experience of it. Yeast, given the right temperature and mixed with dough under the right circumstances, transforms the whole loaf. You don't have to sit next to it saying, come on, yeast. Come on, yeast. Or, I've got to think about the yeast. I have to worry about the yeast. Is it working? I don't know if it's working. Let me work about this. Yeast just works. And it kind of blows itself up, and then you get to punch it and work it. It's a great thing to do if you have a little difficulty with anger. May I suggest baking bread, and don't use the machine. Do it the way Grandma used to do it. Like, did you ever wonder, gee, when the family gets together, why does Grandma bake so much bread? Grandma, we don't need any more. Yes, we do. You know? It was a way of discharging lots of this stuff that happens when the family... And Grandpa chopped wood. You know? Well, I don't know, he's chopping wood again. He and Grandma were talking and he left, and she's baking bread and he's chopping wood. What a happy family. They had outlets. They had outlets. Now, Rumi, who is, I think, breathtaking as a poet, one of the images, he likes the bread image. The bread image is a real rich one that a lot of us use. Bread is a real staple for life. And the basic food that lots of people eat. Rumi, in one of his insights, says, God, turn me into a well-baked loaf. So the image of being someone who's mature and useful, you know, and kind of processed and a well-baked loaf. But it means you get punched, you know. Yeah, that's right, we get punched. Sabbath day. How do we understand God? We understand God through our own experience. Lots of us have ideas about God. I don't know of any bad old idea about God that died just because it was a bad old idea. Oh, it's bad. I'm sure it'll die. Bad old ideas have a way of holding on. And sometimes, if your head is full of bad old ideas, you've got to actively recruit good new ideas and let them fight it out. We need sometimes some real information that's useful and helpful. The rule of thumb for understanding God that I think is pretty valid for most of us is we understand God through our own experiences. This is why at meetings we don't need to talk theology, we need to talk about our experiences. People will identify on experiences. And then you can draw some conclusions from that. For many, many, many of us, the first hint of a The first hint of spirituality that's not toxic is recovery. You see, sick people start to get well. And that gives you an idea of God. God takes sick people and gets them well. This frequently takes a long time. My sponsor, who needs meetings very badly, and we're watching closely, says, the only person sicker than a newcomer at that newcomer's first meeting is that newcomer's version of the higher power. Because we come in with a lot of distortions. The God who is enraged, a lot of us have that. The God who is far away, a lot of us have that. That's my personal favorite. The shrinks tell us, and I think they're right, that our first experience with higher power is mom and dad. So if you have an awful lot of difficulty with higher power stuff, the question I would ask is, how well did you get along with mom and dad? If you are terrified of eternal damnation and smell fire and brimstone, I think I'd ask if there was a lot of screaming at home when you were a kid. You know? Was one of your parents a bully? Was one of your parents physically violent? Just fundamental question. My dad was this wonderful man who everybody liked, and he was very involved in a lot of stuff, and he would come home and have a couple of drinks and pass out. So, my idea of God, God's wonderful. And very effective for you. However, has no time for me. And I just figured that was true forever. I relate a lot to Franz Kafka, who was not an optimist, and I would not recommend reading him unless you've got about 5 years in the program. He was a little moody. But it says true things, you know. Kafka, in one of his essays, writes, "There is infinite hope, but not for us." Okay. I can't tell you how I identify with that. See, I know it's going to work out for you, but I'm doomed, you know. And no matter how hard I try, I'm doomed. Part of my recovery, God, as I understand God, I had to change my understanding of God, because my little boy's understanding of God was not going to keep me sober. And I had to realize that God wasn't far off. God was involved in my life. How do I know this? I'm not loaded at the moment. This is what opened the door. Now, there's lots of stories about God. I mean, I like the ones of mustard seed and yeast and field and seed. I like all that stuff. That helps me a lot. One of the oldest stories is the business of God creating in 6 days, you know, all kinds of things. And on the seventh day, God rests, however that story goes. It's early Genesis. The way some of the rabbis dealt with that story, because they're trying to understand. They're trying to take a look at where does God start and we end, and where do we start and God ends, and what's the mixture, and is God present or is God far away? Or there's a lot of conversation on this, you know. Some of the founding fathers of the United States, like Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Madison, they were people who believed that they were deists. God started everything, the universe, as this great big clock and then went away. So everything works perfectly. It's like Isaac Newton's universe. And this is what they believed in, you know. God was not personally involved. God was the great clockmaker in the sky. Well, that helps a lot of people. Doesn't help me. Aristotle described God as God is thought thinking itself. Doesn't do much for me either. I have some real difficulty with the way that Jesus is presented by some. Makes the skin crawl off my bones. Really does. I mean, I just go, oh no, you don't mean that. I just am so horrified. I get to choose the God of my understanding. I need to hear other people talk about how they understand. But that doesn't mean I'm going to agree with these folks. And I have to go with what's consistent with my experience. I'm glad to say it's also in my tradition, so I don't feel schizophrenic there. But looking at God creating. Ignatius Loyola, in the mid-1500s, will have a keen vision. It's like he channeled for a little bit. If you think that channeling started with Ram Thaw, it's been going on for a long, long time. Most of it fraudulent. But every so often there are these true voices that come through. And Loyola has this vision of God and Jesus and connection. And what he emerges from that with this conviction. The God we worship, the God we worship is still at work. That's number one, as he begins his entry into the world of spirituality and service. The God who created is still creating. Things didn't stop on the sixth day and now we're waiting for the end. God is still very much at work here and now. Creation's ongoing. There's always new things emerging. And the old is passing away, but new things, it's like yeast. Teilhard de Chardin, whom I like a lot, Chardin, C-H-A-R-D-I-N, will look at everything we see, and Chardin will say, if you look at everything we see, you can conclude that there is nothing new under the sun, nothing has ever changed, it's always been this way. That's one whole, and there are a lot of people who think like that. Everything's static, fossilized, nothing changes. We're just waiting for the end. Or, Chardin said, you could look at all of this as we are at the crest, the very, very crest, the edge of this wave that is moving forward. Developing, evolving, changing. That's the one I choose to believe in. We're yeast. It's mustard seed. It's growing. The sixth day, it's still the sixth day. There's a lot going on. And, Loyola will say, we are called to labor with the God who labors. We are called to participate in the work of building the earth. How will recovery ever get to the prisons? One of us takes it there. Usually someone with no social skills or friends. And everyone else thinks they're weird. And they go in and people get well. It's amazing who gets used. Ignatius Loyola prayed that as you saw God at work, or as the eyes of faith for Loyola were looking around to notice not just God present, but God at work, and the two always go together for him, to pray for the willingness to participate to some degree with God's work. And if you don't have the willingness to participate, pray for the willingness for the willingness. Which is a notion that is picked up very much in the program. If you don't want to get well, okay. Are you willing to be willing to get well? Are you willing to be willing to be willing to get well? Is the door open at all? And you'll meet people who will tell you, it's all or nothing, black or white, 100% or zero. And I would like to suggest that that's alcoholism talking. The real lived experience of women and men is lots of things start small. Mustard seed, yeast. And that if a door is just open the smallest amount, it's open. And it can be opened further. In fact, some of us can't stand the thought of an open door at all. We're too terrified or too angry. But we're willing to let the door be unlocked. Sometimes. And what's startling is if in our heart and our head we're willing, just barely, barely willing to have the door unlocked sometimes, occasionally, God can work. And little things become great big things. we are on the edge of a wave, of a crest, of change. We are yeast in the dough, and other people are yeast for us. And we are mustard seed for some, and others have been mustard seed for us. For your spiritual practice this afternoon, what I'd like you to do, unless you want to take a nap again, which I would approve of, because I always approve of naps, but you might want to take a few moments and make a list of the women and men in your life who have been mustard seed and yeast to you. People who have made a significant difference. Most of them don't know. It may be someone at a meeting. It might be a relative who may be dead for years now. It might be an old teacher. I was having lunch with Bernie Bush today, and I just remembered 25 years ago, I was in tremendous trouble emotionally and spiritually, and I needed to talk to someone very, very badly. And there was a Jesuit in Los Angeles that spent the afternoon with me, and we had conversation, and he spent the next couple of days walking me through a real crisis, capital C. I've never thanked him. And as what I realized is I just hadn't thought about this in 25 years. One of the things I need to do as a way of making amends is to thank him. Write him a letter, just a real simple one, saying thank you for that summer day when you spent the time to listen to me as I was in crisis. He was mustard seed for me. He listened. He let me walk through it. And he showed understanding and compassion. That's a great gift. So, who in your life has been mustard seed and yeast? This can go on to a gratitude list, you know. And then you might know of others that you have been mustard seed and yeast for, although probably you don't. Because one of the things about mustard seed and yeast is it's anonymous. It's anonymous. And the people you think you're having a big influence on don't even know you're alive. And other people that you just met are very grateful for your life. This morning, I thought I'd just start off by talking about some very difficult things. Why not? Now that some of you at least have relaxed a little, you can't talk about some of these things on Friday night or people run out the door screaming. And lots of times before I can hear anything, I need some regular meals and some sleep. And I find if I remember that, regular meals, some sleep, before I go into a stressful situation, I can usually handle it better. And then after I've been in a stressful situation, I find I need some regular meals and some sleep. It's real important. But what I want to just massage a little bit this morning, it's taking a look at the alcoholism, which in our literature we talk about as being embarrassing and confusing and illogical, and how it can baffle a lot of us, especially if you're not alcoholic yourself. And even many alcoholics get very, very confused by this stuff. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, they have a pamphlet, which very few people read, called Problems Other Than Alcohol. And the fact of the matter is, and this is the difficult subject, although you may be in relationship of some sort with an alcoholic, alcoholism might not be the only problem. And this makes our world a little more complicated than otherwise. What do I have in mind? Well, an awful lot of us with an alcohol problem also regularly have great problems with depression. And you think, one of the reasons I was depressed for years was because I was taking depressants into my body on a daily basis. You know, a little alcohol and non-habit forming marijuana. Why am I so depressed? And I, I did not see those things as depressants. I saw them as relaxants, you see, which is a distinction without a difference. That's, they almost call it what, content-free language. The fact is, if you have a problem with depression, the last thing you want to be doing is drinking and using sedatives, because it just increases that tremendously. And so folks get sober, and I'm not talking about the extremes of depression, which also are major problems for a lot of us, but the mood swings. In fact, they're not even swings after a while, but there's a definite rhythm and a definite movement. And there's going to be whatever normal feels like. There's a wide range of normal. And some people have periods of more up, and some people have periods of more down. The first time I met with my acupuncturist, I was the first person in my home group to have an acupuncturist, I want you to know. And I see her once a month for basic well-being. I figure the Chinese know things, you know. They asked crusty old Mao Zedong, what are the two Chinese contributions to civilization? And he said, food and medicine. You know, and he's right on both scores, as far as I'm concerned. But I figure go once a month and get acupunctured for basic well-being. I do that, but the acupuncturist was asking about how I felt and how things are, and she said, what time of the day do you feel most energy? What time of the day? I had no idea what she was talking about. What do you mean? I was so out of touch. I didn't know that the normal rhythm is there are periods of the day with a lot of energy, and there are periods of the day with little energy, and that pretty much works for people. This is why civilized countries lie down after lunch, you see, because there's not a lot of energy there. If you want to deal with someone who is not operating on all six cylinders, talk to them at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know. Some of us wake up in the morning and we're just ready to go, and I find in the morning I can be pretty productive. I can get a lot done, and then there's a big slump in the afternoon, and then in the evening there's another boost of energy. That's a pretty normal rhythm. Well, some of us have those rhythms throughout the year. Sometimes we're up and sometimes we're down, and some of us find summer to be our very, 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 very best time of the year. We like the light, it's so wonderful, oh look, it's warm. That's not my current response to summer. You need to know that. I have found that I'm always able to find something wrong with the weather. You know, the winter's too dark and the summer's too light, as far as I'm concerned. And with the complexion I have, when I see those long sunny days and those big sunny beaches, I think of skin cancer. So I'm not your basic optimist. So there's a normal thing with, you know, up and down. But there's a lot of alcoholics who go way outside of normal for up and down, and a lot of alcoholics also deal with manic depression. And, I mean, that's extreme up, extreme down. That's called bipolar. Some people are monopolar. They just go down. And some just go up. These are real difficult. And what happens with manic depressives is we do try, and I'm not manic depressive, but manic depressives try to, at least not yet, I could probably be by tomorrow if I think about it, with cholera following close behind. But it's these mood swings, and you try to medicate the mood swings, you self-medicate, and alcohol is a real common help for a lot of us who are manic depressive. Because it balances things out, at least initially. And then they explode, and it gets very crazy. You get sober, and you're still manic depressive. And so you need to deal with problems other than alcohol. And with manic depression, God did not invent the third step to deal with manic depression. God invented lithium. And people who are manic depressive really need the care of a skilled physician who knows the subject matter very well. And then you have to talk to that physician regularly, and then you have to follow directions and follow your medication. And manic depressives that I know hate that. Hate it. They'll follow the directions. They'll get back on normal mood swings. They'll kind of have a normal life. And then they'll say, clearly, I'm cured. And then almost every manic depressive I know goes off the medication because they're feeling so good. So being that I'm feeling so good, why do I need the medication? You see the logic? And this is why it's a real loss of control to be on medication as far as they're concerned, and they feel dirty. And I try to explain, if you were a diabetic who needed insulin, would you feel this dirty?
Well, no, but that's different.
No, it's not different. It's not different. Where addicts get into trouble is we diagnose ourselves and we're experts. We diagnose ourselves and then we medicate ourselves. So if you know someone who has problems other than alcohol, I'm nervous about telling this to an Al-Anon group. But the best thing is to have that person connected to a competent physician. The word competent there is real important. And have that person follow directions in terms of medication. I mean, follow directions. One of my friends who suicided 2 years ago, lots of depression, lots of things going on, saw a physician who gave her like 12 pounds of Prozac. Oh, you're depressed. Take this. Here, 12 pounds. And then what Pat would do is when she was feeling lousy, she'd follow the form. Then she was feeling better, she'd stop using the medication. And then she'd feel lousy again, so she doubled the medication to catch up. See, this is what addicts do all the time. So it's just, it's that loss. We need to follow directions. What do we need? And for those of us in Al-Anon, if we have those kinds of problems, we need to follow directions too. We need to follow directions too. It's not at all uncommon for addicts and alcoholics to also have wild craziness around food issues. And lots of members of Al-Anon too. Anorexia, bulimia, a compulsive overeating. There's all kinds of ways that we can get nuts around food. I mean, I'll find that, you know, there's eating and then there's eating. And every so often I will find myself, I mean, really abusing food. I'll be standing in front of the refrigerator eating ice cream out of the container. And I would suggest this is not normal ice cream eating. You know, and it's a way of just trying to deal with basic, you know, I'm feeling empty, I'm going to fill up somehow, you know, or I don't want to feel some stuff, I get so angry, I'll eat. I mean, that's stuff I need to watch at, take a look at. And there are other things. Bill Wilson, and this is one of the things that I can go into a little more detail on. Bill Wilson had all kinds of problems with depression throughout his life. And it's one of the reasons Lois needed Al-Anon. To deal with Bill's moods. And it's hard to live or visit or have lunch with someone who's real ill. They exhaust us. And if we're surrounded by sickness, they're draining our energy all the time. So we really do need lots of help. There's a book written last year. It's published by Hazelton. It's called The Soul of Sponsorship by Robert Fitzgerald. This is a book dealing with the correspondence between Bill Wilson and his spiritual director, a priest named Father Edward Dowling from St. Louis, who was a Jesuit. And Edward Dowling was his director for 20 years. And then he died in 1960. But they sure corresponded about a lot of things, and it talks about some of the things that make those of us in recovery very anxious. Alcoholics are terrified of depression. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to talk about following doctor's orders. We just get nuts on these things. And the image we want to have as sober alcoholics is that you stop drinking and everything's fine. And if you've lived with someone like that, you know that that's not true. You know, it can be real complicated. This is from this text, The Soul of Sponsorship. And in 1943, 1944, Bill and Lois made a tour of the provinces. They visited all of the AA hangouts in America, and I guess Toronto too, and waved at people and gave little talks and inspired folks. And it went very, very well. Now, the guy that internationalized AA, or not, well, I guess internationalized, but the guy who definitely got AA out of Akron, Ohio, was Jack Alexander, who wrote an article in 1940, 1941 in the Saturday Evening Post, and even though he's not an alcoholic, he explained the program brilliantly to the whole English-speaking world. It is a message of hope and practicality. It's a great article, but therefore AA groups sprung up everywhere, and Bill and Lois go and visit them, and it's wildly successful. Things worked real, real well. People were glad to be living lives. Spouses and family members were so glad that their wife or their husband was sober, that their dad has gotten sober, that their brother or sister was sober. So it was pretty positive. Bill and Lois returned home in January 1944. The tour had been a success for Bill and the fellowship. What happened next came as a complete surprise. Bill was plunged into a suicidal depression that would last until 1955. Put yourself in Lois's shoes. He's not drinking, but he's barely living. Boy, you really do need... when I was doing, for a period of several years, I did some direct stuff with people with AIDS. Regularly and every week. And for 4 years, I did some work at the Center for People with AIDS in Oakland. If you were doing that kind of work, the rule was you had to be in a support group that met every week.
Well, I don't need that.
Yes, you do. If you're with sick people, you need somewhere where you can go where you can get dealt with, where you can get energy, where you can get fed, where you can get nourished, where you can get listened to, where you can have a couple of laughs. Because then you go back to the very stressful situation. This is why for some of us, meetings become oases. You know, the only center of sanity in a totally crazy world. For some of us, it's the only place we're safe. And this is why it's real important that meetings follow all the traditions. You know, because otherwise, they're not safe. You know, the equal respect, the mutuality, the mutual vulnerability, the paying attention to each other, that careful boundary observance stuff becomes vital at an Al-Anon meeting. I have been to meetings where one person who was a bit of a control freak took over the meeting and, you know, has been in charge of it now for 12 years. And this happens in Al-Anon because we have control issues, and if we can meet someone who can run everything, a lot of us relax. So it meets our craziness. But that makes us all even crazier. You know? If you want to look at places that where one person runs everything efficiently, look at what used to be East Germany and what is North Korea today. You know, these are unhappy places, but they're clean. You know? But they're dictatorships. And we don't need little dictatorships in our world, I don't think. Let me just do a little bit here on Bill and depression. Again, because this is a terrifying thing for alcoholics. And they don't talk about it. It's never a topic at a meeting. And if someone gets depressed, what will happen is there will be a whole group that line up and say, work harder.